From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So in 1997, we got a group of women together and we decided we would use the vagina monologues as the basis for something called V-Day. A spirit, a day, Valentine's Day, a movement, an energy, a decision, a determination to end violence against women.
Today, a Valentine's Day special with Eve Ensler, Gloria Steinem, singer Joan Osborne, and women who've survived genital mutilation. Also, flowers and chocolate. Haven't bought them yet? You might want to wait till the end of the show. And the band Betty, live. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman.
Hi, I'm Eve Ensler. I'm the writer of The Vagina Monologues and one of the founding members of V-Day, a global movement to end violence against women.
Can you tell us exactly what V-Day is and this remarkable event that took place on Saturday night?
V-Day started 4 years ago. It grew out of when I started to perform The Vagina Monologues around the world. I went to all kinds of cities, and every time I performed it, women would literally line up after the performance to tell me how they had been raped or battered or suffered from incest or mutilation, and I began to feel insane. And I started to think that I really couldn't keep doing this piece if I didn't do something about it. So in 1997, we got a group of women together, and we decided we would use the vagina monologues as the basis for something called V-Day, a spirit, a day, Valentine's Day, a movement, an energy, a decision, a determination to end violence against women. And in 1998, we launched our first V-Day, which ironically was at the same space that the party of this year's event was held in. There were 2,500 people, and we did the vagina monologues with all these great women performers, including Glenn Close and Susan Sarandon and Whoopi Goldberg and all kinds of fabulous women. And that really launched the movement. And for the last 4 years, it has been performed at venues around the world on V-Day and at hundreds and hundreds of colleges, each college doing their own performance of the vagina monologues to raise money for local groups to end violence. And this year, it'll be performed in 50 cities, 250 colleges, and we did the most astounding event Saturday night at Madison Square Garden. We sold it out to 18,000 people, and the theme was to rock, rally, rise up, and to take back the garden to make the world safe for women and their bodies. And I really feel we took back the garden.
What are the vagina monologues?
The vagina monologues are a series of monologues based on interviews I did with over 200 women about their vaginas, discovering their sexuality, their stories, their violations, their joys, their celebrations, their histories, their experiences. And I think they're really an examination of women's sexuality and hopefully a liberation of women's sexuality. And I think the desire was really to get women to love their bodies and celebrate their bodies and feel good about their bodies so that violation becomes impossible.
Why did you end up doing this? What is it in your experience?
Well, I'm a survivor of violence, and I also deeply care about women. I really love women, and I know that we are the resource of this planet, which is keeping life alive. And when you think that at this point, one out of every three women on this planet will be raped or beaten, it's the destruction, essentially, of a gender. And that gender is the life-giving gender on the planet.
One of the most impressive parts of Madison Square Garden event was the people from the women from around the world. Can you talk about your experience of interviewing women in different places and their response, even to saying the word vagina?
Well, you know, it's been varied in different places, but the women who were there that night were women who I'd actually met on my last journey around the world where I'm interviewing women for a new piece. But I had met Agnes and Beatrice in Africa, and I had met Zoya in Afghanistan, and all of these women moved me so much, I felt it was really important that we bring them here for V-Day so they could share their stories with a larger audience.
What kind of response do you get from the corporate media? I mean, even having to say the title.
It's been incredible. It's really changed. I have to say, we are everywhere right now. And when I started, it certainly wasn't that way. But now, I can't open a magazine or look at a TV without them talking about vaginas. It's good news. We've broken through.
Tell me what your plans are for today, Valentine's Day.
I will be flying to Washington, D.C., And I will be doing a press conference with a whole group of women, including Carol Black, the president of Lifetime, and Jane Fonda, and Zoya, who's from Rawa, from Afghanistan. And we will be presenting the Valentines that were written at Madison Square Garden, urging Congress to support VAWA, the Violence Against Women Act, and to support the women of Afghanistan, and to make violence against women a primary issue in Congress. And then that night I'll be flying to Mexico City, where V-Day will be celebrated. And then I'm flying from there to 8 other cities, including Santa Fe, Bulgaria, Rome, Paris, Atlanta, Georgia, where I'm going to be visiting and giving speeches at V-Day celebrations around the world. It's only 8 of the 50 celebrations, but I can't go everywhere.
Have a good trip.
Okay, great. Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Eve Ensler. She is the author of The Vagina Monologues and the founder of the V-Day celebrations. Happy Valentine's Day.
You too.
Na 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 na. I'm Humpty Dumpty, who's had a great fall. I'm mixed up and messed up and all turned around. I'm upset, downset, and no fun at all. I'm people, just people, and I'm broken. All the queen's horses and all the queen's men can't patch me, nor mend me, nor glue me together. I'm upset, downset, and I want it to end. I'm people, just people, and I'm broken. Oh, it hurts when I laugh. I can't even smile, so I guess I'll stay broken a while. If I were a watch, I'd get quickly repaired or stitched up and sewn like a dress with a tear. But I'm people, just people, and I'm broken, broken. Oh, 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 oh.
We'll stay broken together forever apart, apart forever. I'm people, your people, and we're broken.
Thank you.
Yay!
Thank you, Amy.
And that's Betty live in the studio here at Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the song they sang on Saturday night at Madison Square Garden. And Betty's website is www.hellobetty.com. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, 18,000 women packed Madison Square Garden last Saturday night to rock, rally, and rise up. They were celebrating V-Day, a worldwide movement to stop violence against women. The key organizer, well, you just heard her, Eve Ensler, author of The Vagina Monologues, a play that'll be performed this year at 250 colleges in 50 cities around the world. The V in V-Day stands not only for vagina, but for victory against a global epidemic of violence against women. In the U.S. every year, up to 4 million women are physically abused by their husbands or live-in partners. Of women who reported being raped or physically assaulted since the age of 18, three-quarters were victimized by someone they knew, a current or former husband, a date, or a boyfriend. Until 1996, from 1976, more than 31,000 women were murdered by someone they knew. These are the kind of statistics that the V-Day Project is trying to change. And on this Valentine's Day, we take a look at the rage and violence against women and the people who are fighting back, with some of the people who performed and spoke on Saturday night at Madison Square Garden.
This is Joan Osborne, and you know, I'm incredibly honored to be a part of this V-Day event. It's really overwhelming to think about this vision that Eve Ensler and the women of V-Day have to actually end violence. And, you know, when I first read this on the press release that they sent me, there was some reaction to me that said, oh, well, that's not possible. And I had to think about that. Why have I internalized this so much in my life that I think it's not possible to end violence against women? What would the world be like without the threat of violence, the fear of violence, the aftermath of violence, the recovery from violence? You know, I just, it's such an amazing vision, and it's, you know, it's almost more than I can take in. So I'm incredibly excited to be here.
What do you see as your role as an artist, as a musician, as a singer?
Well, look around you. There's a million cameras here. There's a million tape recorders here. You know, for better or worse, we live in a society where celebrities or artists are very visible, and people will listen to something that we say. It just makes the issue more visible, I think, to a mass audience, you know, having artists and celebrities here and talking about it. But just as a human being, you know, I feel like it's my duty, just like anyone's duty, to just try to help where I can and do what I can, you know.
How are you received as a political singer?
How am I perceived as a political singer? Oh, received as a political singer.
Do you think it inhibits your celebrity or adds to it?
You know, I think my fans are the kind of people who respect someone who has political opinions and who works for something that they believe in. I don't think that the people who are my fans are interested in somebody who's just going to, you know, quietly go shopping with their time. You know, I really believe that. I think, it, you know, people who are political and active and passionate about things are more interesting to themselves and to their audiences. You know?
So. Can you talk about the song you chose to sing today?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a song called Saint Teresa. And I wrote it about a woman that I used to see on my corner in New York City, who was a single mom, and she was selling drugs on the street, and she had her child in a stroller next to her as she was doing this. And I saw this woman all the time, and I came to be sort of fascinated by her and almost to really admire her for being able to keep her child safe on this really, you know, in this dirty street in New York. And I just sort of gave her the name of Teresa. And then I also did some reading about the 15th century Saint Teresa, the nun, who had these mystical visions and was ordered by her superiors in the church to write down everything she saw in these visions. So she became one of the great Christian mystics. And the song is really about someone who is kind of fascinated with both of these two characters and seeing the similarities between these two women and between the experience of mysticism and the experience of, you know, looking to someone on the street to sell you a drug that's going to take you out of yourself, you know.
Which CD is it on?
It's on Relish, yeah.
Reach down for the sweet stuff where she looks at me. Like that.
just a little cry. When I make my money, got to get my dime. We're down in the hollow.
Hi, I'm Amy.
Hi, I'm Amy also.
Hi, Amy.
Amy Wine.
I'm Amy Ziff.
Hi, I'm Amy Good.
Betty.
What does V-Day mean to you?
V-Day means a beginning, you know, just a real big promise of a beginning. And I don't really see an end to it, you know. I mean, I see, like, people getting more involved and more involved. And, I mean, I see an end to the violence. I wish it would happen during my lifetime. I don't know if it would, but I see beginnings.
What's it like to get by as a political singer?
You know, I'm not. We're not. Betty is not political. We never do political lyrics or anything like that. We sing for a lot of causes. We've always have. So, I guess...
Certainly feminist.
Very feminist. You know, I think just because we're strong women and we sing and, you know, we say our mind, I think that means that it's a political statement, I guess, maybe in its own way.
My name is Gloria Steinem, and having started out the movement wearing a little button that said cunt power, which was at the time considered extremely daring, and seeing it now in Madison Square Garden with music, song, dances, and international connections is truly gratifying. Doesn't make up for the fact that George Bush is in the White House, but it's gratifying.
And John Ashcroft is Attorney General.
Yes, I can't believe it. You know, it's really, do you want to talk about John Ashcroft? I mean, I can't believe that somebody who is such a right-wing extremist and who has done things that if any centrist or progressive candidate had done would disqualify them, like intervene on behalf of a man accused of trying to murder an FBI agent. I mean, you know, if any other candidate had done that, would have been dead in the water. It's a man named Dr. Sell, who is a dentist in Missouri, who is part of a white supremacist group. And he was, Ashcroft was asked to write a letter on his behalf or to intervene in some form on his behalf because he had been arrested for Medicaid fraud and then spent several unwise weeks plotting to kill the FBI agent who arrested him on the phone. You know, I mean, it's outrageous. It's such a double standard, and it's so clear that the election was stolen. I ended up by accident in Palm Beach County Community College the morning after the election, watching people realize that they had had their vote taken away by that ballot, or that they had been unable to vote for all kinds of reasons. And now I think we're clear that even a recount would have taken the victory away from Bush, much less a re-vote, which is what it should have been. So my only hope is that this is the first time since the Civil Rights Movement that we're focusing on voting, and that the whole country has been educated about how inefficient and often corrupt the system is. So I hope we can use that knowledge.
And back to this V-Day movement that seems to be taking hold around the world. What can you explain it?
Wherever there is a kind of sexual caste system, there is violence against women, which means, except for very small pockets in some cultures, pretty much everywhere. So since what happens to women is called culture and what happens to men is called politics, even to name it and even to talk about women's body parts, you know, like vaginas and so on, is still a political act. I understand that 60 Minutes wouldn't do a piece on vagina monologues because they wouldn't say vagina. And I actually got involved in this some years ago because when Eve was doing a book of the script of Vagina Monologues, the publishing houses didn't want to put vagina on the jacket. So she asked me to write the introduction to the book, which I did. So, to move from there to full-throated, artistic, creative activist representation in Madison Square Garden is no small thing.
So do you think we're seeing two different sort of threads in this country now? You've got the extremely conservative president-select and his team, and then you've got these grassroots movements on all different issues.
Well, I think that the first that the ultra right wing is a backlash against the success of the social justice movements, and it could suppress them. I mean, there's just because the majority now supports many issues doesn't mean they will win, as we've seen in the election. So we have to make sure we're in it for the long haul.
What does Valentine's Day mean to you?
Well, ever since I lived in India and I figured out that the heart was a yoni, was a residual female genital symbol, I've been suspicious about all those arrows. And also, Valentine's Day has had a whole different meaning for me. You know, it's true that this symbol of female power was reduced to romance, but it's still a symbol of female power. And when I see little girls putting hearts above the eyes in their names and see the kind of almost primordial attraction to the heart, it's instructive. And I just think we need to put the power back. Take the chocolates out and put the power back.
Now that you've been married for, a couple months, do you think you made the right decision?
Yes, actually. But if you, you know, it's the most shocking thing about it is that it's not shocking. It seems perfectly natural. But I think it's good to wait till you're 66.
Gloria Steinem, among many other women, 18,000 to be precise, at Madison Square Garden this past Saturday night. And we're going to continue with the V-Day celebration, Rock Rally, Rise Up, Demanding an End to Violence Against Women, in just a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio Democracy Now!'s Valentine's Day celebration and special. This is V-Day, Rock, Rally, Rise Up, Demanding an End to Violence Against Women. Last Saturday night, 18,000 women and men took Madison Square Garden to demand an end to violence against women, as we continue with some of those who spoke.
My name is Soraya Mirai, and I'm from Somalia. I did a film called Fire Eyes on Female Genital Mutilation, 94, that won the United Nations. And I'm doing a feature based on FGM also.
So, what about your own experience with female genital mutilation?
My own experience? You want to know my experience? That's what you're asking? Yeah, I had it when I was 13 years old in Somalia. And the thing that was really hard for me was I didn't know this was going to happen to me because, you know, my mother thought, she told me that she was going to buy me a gift to come with her, and I, you know, thought I was going to get a gift, but this means also a gift. So that's what happened to me. So it really changed my life.
How?
It was kind of like a betrayal of love. The person who loved you the most, with your mother, you know, did this to you. But it's not like she really was mean to me or anything like that. I know she loves me, but it's just a tradition that needs to be really understood and just change.
Now that you've become an activist and filmmaker against female genital mutilation, how has your mother responded?
I remember my mother when I came back from Sundance. That was, I remember, 94, 10th of 94. She saw me in a nightline with Ted Koppel. And I got home from the interview to see myself on TV. And I got a call from my mother. I haven't seen her like 15 years. because they cut me off altogether, becoming an activist and doing stuff on genital mutilation. And when I heard my mother, I just couldn't believe it. And what she was asking was forgiveness. And I love her so much, of course. I mean, I've always forgiven her all my life, you know. I love my mother. So that was a healing for her and for me. So that's God's gift.
Have you seen her since?
Yeah, I went to her when my father passed away.
And what effect do you think the whole movement against female genital mutilation has had?
I think what it had was it made people think that, you know, we could keep the tradition, what we have that is good, and try to take out and eliminate which is bad, which is torture of body of human being, a child, whether it's a male or female. It's really a genital mutilation, even for boys, for me. So I think it educated people. They're trying to understand women. They're trying to honor what God gave us all. So I think it really made people think twice, even if they don't like you being an activist, you know.
What has this whole V-Day phenomenon meant for you?
For me, it's really honoring our body. Standing up, don't be afraid whether you're mutilated, raped, incest, anything, to stand up and say, I am one of those women. Like I was saying, I am one of those 130 million women that have undergone genital mutilation. It gives you power for you to honor who you are so that you could do something. For me, it's really a weapon, like a film, where you could make people cry, laugh, think, angry at the same time in 1-2 hours. So it's a really empowering act.
What do you think is a ritual for young women in the Sudan and other places that can replace female circumcision?
I think one thing that I think is really to honor what we are, the way God made us. Because we have no power and no right to say the Creator is wrong. I, human being who shits, would do something to correct God's mistake. So I think the thing to honor for women is the period. The minute you get your period, your breast, you get hairs, you know, your vagina, things like that. It's an honoring, knowing that you could bring a life into this earth. And for boys to honor where they came from, the womb of the mother.
What's the difference between your first and second film?
I think my first was the hardest thing because it took me 12 years to make, because I had to face my own pain to the world, to say, I, Soraya Mireille, as a human being, this happened to me. It was the hardest thing because people will look at me differently. I never wanted to look like I'm a victim, but I understand the power of victimism because you could understand your pain. And that was really the hardest film I ever done. And the second one is really overcoming and getting my strength as a woman, as an African woman, and as a human being. It's, and knowing how to make films is better. Oh, you know what I mean? So I thank God. Everything I do is God's honor. I'm just a missionary for God. I'm a messenger for God. So every day, whatever good I do is for God.
My name is Beatrice Tarome. I come from Kenya, from Rift Valley province, from a district called Narok. I'm a Maasai by tribe, and I'm a victim of FGM. I refused to undergo FGM. That was back in 1995.
Female genital mutilation.
Female genital mutilation. That was back in 1995. It was not that easy for me because I had to be sent away from home by my father. And he neglected me. He didn't pay for me my school fees. And my mother, who is just a mere shopkeeper, struggled and paid for me school fees. And last year, I met Eve and Calista, the Equality Now friends. We were together. They invited me to stay. Currently, I'm at home. I've got no finance to continue to college because of the female genital mutilation. Because when I refused to undergo it, my father couldn't continue to pay for me school. So I've cleared Form 4, I'm an old leaver, I'm at home, I'm trusting God to open a door for me to go to college. I'm hoping to train as a social worker. What made me to want to train as a social worker is to create an awareness to other girls like me. And I wanted to also, I like training social work so that it can make me to be close with people. I'm so happy to be in New York. The people are so friendly. And I just have to say that, and God bless you so much.
Why do you say you're a victim of female genital mutilation since you refuse to have it done?
Yeah, I refuse to undergo it. And generally, it's not that easy to refuse to undergo it. Well, okay, once you want to refuse, you have to be ready to be an outcast. You have to suffer even psychologically, because maybe if it's in school, you'd miss friends. Maybe if it's in the village, you'd miss friends. People would neglect you. And my tribe or my community are people who really regard culture a lot. So to refuse to undergo it, you have to suffer the consequences.
How old were you when you said
when
no?
When I refused, I was 18.
What gave you the strength to say no?
Okay, what gave me the strength to say no is the faith, okay, of the religion from which I come from. And then, okay, and personally, I didn't like it because I've been hearing it from other girls, how painful it is. And I've read it from books, and I know it can, okay, for example, one risk of it can cause HIV virus. Because, okay, the cutting, the blade used for cutting, it's not done on one person, it's done on a number of girls. So I really had to stand up and say no to that because I didn't want to risk my life when I'm knowing. But it was not that easy. I really had to be ready to stand as an outcast.
And you inspired your sister to say no.
Yeah, my younger sister. It was on condition. If I could have undergone for FGM, she could have also undergone for it. And because I didn't undergo for it, she also stood and said no.
Other girls, other young women in your culture, are they saying no now because of you?
Yeah, currently we have around 13 girls who are staying in the church.
How many?
13 who have said no to female genital mutilation, and they are sent away from their homes. So the only place they can seek refuge is from the church and from the group known as Tasarundomonok, which is led by Agnes.
How do young men regard you?
Oh, they really, previously they didn't like us, but when they came to know the effects of it, because when we go for field work, normally it's the teaching on FGM, it's not only done for the girls, it's done even for the men. So most of them, especially those in the church, they're standing up and saying, no, me, I can't marry a wife who a girl who has undergone FGM. So most of them are also standing with us and saying no to FGM.
How did it feel to tell your story in Madison Square Garden with 18,000 people cheering you on?
I really felt so moved. It reminded me of that time. And that's how you find I cried, because it reminded me of that very time. The day, you know, it was not easy because my father bet me. So when I stood there to talk of it, it really reminded me.
Has your father accepted it now?
Home. He accepted me back home. But anything to do with my future, like college, what, is so less concerned. In fact, he didn't know I was coming for that issue here. I just told him I'm going for a visit to New York, because if I could have told him I'm coming to campaign for the FGM, he could have refused me to come. So we told him I'm coming to visit friends here. So he didn't know what I was coming to do.
My name is Agnes Pareyo from Kenya.
And tell me the project that you've pioneered in Kenya.
My project is rescuing girls, those who are victims of female circumcision and early marriages. Because in our community, we marry girls at an early age. And circumcision is a must for every girl.
What exactly do you do? We saw pictures of you at the Madison Square Garden event walking through the countryside.
I educate the community on the dangers of female circumcision. And I also educate them on knowing their bodies well, because that has never been discussed in our community.
What inspired you to do this?
I underwent female circumcision by force, and I felt it, and because I felt I didn't want it. So there was that bitterness in me. Female circumcision is a culture like any other culture, and there are so many that have stopped. It's only that female circumcision is have never been discussed. So it's not funny to discuss it, because it is one among many other cultures that have stopped. And as a result of the HIV, you know what they use. They use one object and then maybe use that the same object to another person, and that can transmit the virus. And it made us start discussing all that.
I'm Sarah Jones, and I'm a writer and performer affiliated with Equality Now, which is a women's rights organization, and V-Day, because I'm a performer and I was in Vagina Monologues in New York, so I'm kind of involved in V-Day and the Stop Rape Contest from both ends.
And what is the Stop Rape Contest?
The Stop Rape Contest is essentially something that was coordinated in conjunction with V-Day, or as part of V-Day, by Equality Now. It was sort of a challenge or a contest that was sent out all over the world, kind of overseen by various site coordinators in 11 regions all over the world. And it basically challenged women in every region to come up with practical, actual plans for action for something concrete to do to stop rape, be it, you know, to implement programs in schools or to come up with some kind of clever slogan or a product or whatever it was, something to actually stop rape. And that's what it was. 60 women ended up coming to New York.
And can you tell us the ideas that won, or just some of the ones that stood out for you and where they were from?
At Silke Pelinga of Germany came up with a wonderful way to talk about rape, to really break the silence in daily life, in the home, where it's so important to talk about it because, you know, there are these misconceptions that strangers are more likely to rape you, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of kind of taboo and myths surrounding, you know, sexual violence in the home. She came up with an idea to print rape anti-rape slogans on sort of the equivalent of a milk carton, but what they buy in Germany a lot, apparently, where she lives, is bread. So all the bakery bags that you bring your bread, your coffee rolls, your whatever home in would be emblazoned with these great slogans, really reminding you at your kitchen table, literally, to think about this and talk about it and, you know, think about stopping it.
The 13-year-old from Kenya, what did she recommend?
Her recommendation, which I love and which I wish had existed when I was in high school, even though I went to a pretty progressive high school, was a club, a stop rape, sort of a youth against rape club for both boys and girls to really be familiar with the notion of violence against women and how important it is to stamp it out at that age, you know, kind of in that social setting when you're in school. To have it be a club, to have it be a you know, sort of a school-sanctioned thing, so that it, just as much as you're getting your three R's, you're also getting this one last R.
Any other message for young people today on Valentine's Day who are listening to this?
Don't waste your money on chocolates or silly greeting cards. They won't do as much good for you in the long run as taking a look in the mirror, thinking about what you can do to eradicate violence against women and other human beings, thinking about the fact that whether you're a man or a woman, violence against other human beings hurts you, and we've just got to stop it. I think we should all, you know, concentrate on Valentine's Day and every day on making violence against women and, you know, the kind of violence that's perpetrated all over the world, the way it is now, human rights violations, a thing of the past, so we can, you know, talk about them with our grandkids, like, remember when, you know.
Could we have chocolate too?
Maybe we could have chocolate, a decaffeinated, defatted soy chocolate would be permissible. No, I'm all for chocolate as long as people are happy and safe while they're eating it.
And we're going to actually talk about chocolates and flowers in just a minute, but we're going to end this V-Day segment as we began it with Betty.
I'm Elizabeth with Betty. Being a part of V-Day is the Valentine to myself. Loving your vagina is a Valentine to you. And one of the great things about V-Day was it was also a celebration of love and hope and power and joy. And that's the song that we want to sing for you now.
As singers who are political, we're sending out a message to everybody. Love yourself, be strong, be empowered. This is our Valentine.
Two cherries, like two cherries in a pie. I know how to cling to you, like two peas up in a pod. I know how to be near you.
It's my
second nature, baby, to want to know every little thing about you.
It's my
second nature, baby, to want to know every little thing about you.
It's my
second nature to love every little thing about you.
Two
cherries, like two kites on a windy day. Oh, I know how to dance with you, like two flags in a parade. Oh, I know how to fly with you.
Oh,
it's my second nature, baby, to want to know every little thing about you.
It's my
second nature, baby, to want to know every little thing about you.
It's my
second nature to love every little thing about you. Come on, come on, come on, come on, come on. Come on to know.
Oh, yeah.
Come on to feel.
Oh, yeah.
Come on to love.
Don't you know I want.
Come on to know.
Oh, yeah.
Come on to feel.
Oh, yeah.
Come on to love. La, 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 la. Like two cherries in a pie, I know how to cling to you. Like two peas up in a pod, I know how to be near you.
Oh,
it's my second nature, baby, to want to know every little thing about you.
It's my
second nature, baby, to want to know every little thing about you.
It's my
second nature to love, love every little thing about you.
Two
cherries.
Hello, Betty, here live at WBAI Pacifica Studios in New York. Wonderful to have you with us. And folks, happy Valentine's Day as we continue with the program. And you can reach Betty at www.hellobetty.com. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Ah, Valentine's Day, a celebration of love, a Hallmark card filled with affectionate verse, a bouquet of flowers, crimson roses for passion, yellow daffodils for joy, and chocolate. A heart-shaped box of truffles as innocent and deliciously sinful as a first kiss. Valentine's Day, what's not to like?
Well, funny you should ask. Today we'll tell you. These lovely flowers, just smell them. They were genetically engineered and grown in Colombia on a giant pesticide-soaked factory farm run by U.S.-owned Dole Foods. The workers, well, maybe they earn $50 a week, spend much of it on the food that needs to be imported now that the land their families work for centuries is used to grow flowers. But the chocolate. Here, have one. This particular box is made from Brazilian cocoa bought up by Nestle or Hershey or one of the other transnational corporations that controls the global trade. The cocoa was grown on cleared rainforest by underpaid workers, often children. Well, you get the picture, and we haven't even mentioned the dioxin in the paper used to make the Hallmark card. But why don't we go into this all in detail? Our Valentine's Day guests are Marianne Mahoney, who is assistant professor of history at Notre Dame, and yes, she is writing a book on chocolate. Joe Winnie is with us from Boston, founder of Organic Commodity Products. But we're going to start with Donovan Hone. He's former associate editor of Harper's, and he wrote this week's piece, Fleur de Mal, Thorny Truths About the Global Flower Trade. What should people know about the flowers they may be about to buy or have bought for Valentine's Day?
Depends on where they bought their flowers, but most of them, 70% of the flowers in the United States are imported, and while some of those come from Holland, the vast majority, 2 trillion stems a year, come from Colombia. Another few trillion come from Ecuador and Costa Rica and Mexico. While there's nothing inherently wrong with flowers grown in Latin America, in theory, in principle, most of these flowers are grown in conditions that are both adverse environmentally and for labor. So the story actually begins in 1965 with the U.S. Agency for International Development went down to Colombia and introduced flower growing as an alternative to growing cocaine, and it grew quickly from a small crop of 17 tons of carnations in 1965 to almost 150,000 tons in recent years. The reason why that the growth was so phenomenal was that Colombian growers aren't subject to most of the environmental regulations that apply to growers in the United States and also have extremely cheap labor. That's the basic story behind the flowers.
These flowers that are grown on the Colombian savanna, who grows them, and what does it take to grow them? They are genetically engineered?
Well, some of them. The genetic engineering in the flower industry begins in 1986, mainly with a company called Florigene, that has now got a subsidiary in Holland and is based in Australia. And they patented a blue flower, blue carnation, and they've since gone on. Monsanto is working on it as well to create genetically engineered flowers that have abnormally long vase lives, unnatural colors of flowers. What it takes to grow the flowers in the Bogota savanna is it takes a lot of labor. It's a very labor-intensive crop. It takes an enormous amount of water. Other crops do as well, but this one doesn't result in a food crop. And the growth of the industry in Bogota has been so quickly that it's not been done in a way that's sustainable, and has contributed to both droughts and floods in the region outside Bogota. And then it also takes daily doses of insecticides and fungicides and herbicides, because unlike food crops that are imported into the United States, flowers not being grown for consumption aren't subject to any pesticide controls. However, they are subject to rigorous inspections by the USDA for insects and other pests. So that there's an incentive for Colombian growers to marinate their flowers in these pesticides, and then also in order to keep costs down, to not necessarily use the same safety measures and precautions that would be used in the States. Moreover, a lot of the pesticides they use in Latin America are ones that are not registered for agricultural use in the United States, which means either that the manufacturer of the pesticide hasn't invested the money to have the thing registered, or it means that the pesticide is considered too dangerous to be legally used in the United States.
And you write that one-fifth of the chemicals are carcinogens or toxins that
have been restricted for health
reasons in the U.S.
That have been restricted for health reasons in the U.S. Or Britain. And there's an extremely high rate. There's estimates are as high as two-thirds of the 75,000-plus flower workers in Colombia suffer a range of symptoms that are associated with pesticide exposure, which in some ways is only to be expected. I mean, there are florists in the United States who I know have, from talking to some organic growers in the United States, who complain of actually having allergic reactions just from handling the pests, the flowers here in the United States, and they're getting it very secondhand from dealing with these flowers. The workers in Colombia will be working in hot greenhouses, sometimes the same day that the greenhouses have been sprayed, which is just not done in the States, sometimes not with the appropriate safety equipment, masks and whatnot. Again, things that gloves that would be standard in the United States.
Okay, maybe flowers aren't a good idea for this Valentine's Day, but maybe chocolates. Let's go to Marianne Mahoney, assistant professor of history at Notre Dame University. You're writing a book on chocolate, but it's called Revisiting the Violent Lands, Bahia's Cacao Region. Well, it doesn't look too promising, but and tell us about the working conditions under which cacao is grown.
Working conditions would depend very much upon the size of the property that the cacao was grown on. There is cacao grown both on small farms and on large estates in the Americas, in Africa, and in Southeast and in Southeast Asia. In Brazil, which I know the greatest amount about, so that we can talk about that, wage labor on the large estates was minimum wage, and it was difficult for workers, in fact, to find farmers that would pay minimum wage in the 1980s, and increasingly in the 1990s as the region entered a crisis because of the witch's broom. Minimum wage in 1980 to 1990 in Brazil would have been about $60 a month. And in Bahia, it was not uncommon for planters to refuse to pay minimum wage. In fact, I remember talking to a planter one day in Ilhéus, the center of the Bahian cacao trade at that time, and as he complained about the high cost of rural labor and complained that there was no reason why a rural worker needed to earn minimum wage. I mean, after all, what would he do with so much money out in the countryside where there was no place to spend it? And while that was going on, the person who owned the farm probably drank a minimum wage and imported whiskey while he was sitting at this bar. So labor was very poorly paid. And often not paid according to Brazilian government standards for minimum wage payment. On small family farms, things might be somewhat different because principally you would have the members of the family working on the farm rather than wage labor.
What about the growth of the large corporations like Hershey and Nestle's?
Well, they're among the largest corporations in the world, and they got their start. Hershey's got its start in 1901 with a $1 million investment of capital from the Hershey Caramel Company, and immediately went on the market with the new milk chocolates that were becoming so popular that had been invented in 1876 in Switzerland. The corporation, which was based in Pennsylvania, in Hershey, Pennsylvania, purchased sugar from Cuba, cacao from around the world, and had its own dairy farms in Pennsylvania as well. And Milton Hershey began a community for the workers in Hershey, as did the people at Cadbury's and various other of the chocolate companies around the Europe and the United States. I mean, one of the interesting things about the history of chocolate manufacture is that Quakers were very important in the development of the chocolate industry, and therefore there were some interesting experiments with labor reform along with the chocolate and cocoa companies.
What about pesticide, the use of pesticide on cocoa plants?
Well, there's some very serious problems with the use of pesticides in cocoa plants, the same kinds of problems with pesticides that one has with other agricultural crops, and that is not only the danger of contamination of the water and the land, but also the danger of contamination of workers. In Nigeria, there are charges that women and children, in particular at harvest time, are having serious problems with gamelin 10 because of because in going into the groves of cacao and breaking open the pods and taking out the seeds, they're dealing barehanded with cacao pods that have been treated with carcinogenic pesticides. The same is probably true in various other, in all of the cocoa producing regions. There is no cocoa can be grown organically, and it can be grown more or less in its natural habitat. But most of the major commercial cacao growing areas use pesticides heavily, with attendant problems with women, and particularly women and children who are used to open the pods and scoop out the seeds after the pod has been cut down from the tree.
Lest anyone lose hope on this Valentine's Day, let's go to Joe Winnie, founder of Organic Commodity Products. Joe, you focus on organic chocolates. Where are they grown? You also talk about cooperatives and workers actually being paid a living wage.
Well, the value of cocoa, especially in an organic model, is that we perceive environmental degradation as an economic issue. And so when you approach it from the point of trade or commerce, you actually have the opportunity to put a program in place that has true economic sustainability. So we look at cocoa farmers as vendors, take a very conservative approach and say if our vendors aren't financially viable, then neither is the business. To take that a step further, in order for them to be viable, they have to be healthy, physically, and have a crop that has a reasonably balanced yield, meaning that the variance in yield can be maintained, and we found that it's best to maintain that yield under a truly environmentally sustainable program.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us as we end on this note of hope on this Valentine's Day. Donovan Hone, former associate editor of Harper's, the piece in this week's Harper's, Fleur du Mal, Thorny Truths About the Global Flower Trade. Also with us from Boston, Joe Winnie, founder of Organic Commodity Products, and Marianne Mahoney from Notre Dame, assistant professor of history, who is writing the book Revisiting the Violent Lands, Bahia's Cacao Region. And that does it for today's program. As I think about it, maybe we should forgo the chocolates and flowers. I know that's going to be hard. And just give your loved one a kiss. On this Valentine's Day, we sign out with Terry Allen and Chris Abrams, our producers, Anthony Sloan, our engineer, Errol Maitland, our technical director, and a special Valentine shout out to Juan Gonzalez, Bernard White, Janice K. Bryant, Sharan Harper, and other friends. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of you, our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!